From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. One journalist says some women hate Governor Sarah Palin because she's hot, or embarrassing, or both. That and more in our Bloggers Roundtable. We've got Sean King, who blogs at seaninthecity.com, Patrice Yersick, who blogs at afrobella.com, and Eric Brown, who writes at detroitnews.com. Welcome, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, Farai.
So, journalist Belinda Luscombe wrote a piece about Sarah Palin. She is a Time magazine reporter, and it's called Why Some Women Hate Sarah Palin. She argues that women don't hate Sarah Palin necessarily because of her politics. She says, quote, "Women are weapons-grade haters. Hillary Clinton knows it. Palin knows it, too. When women get their hate on, they don't just dislike or find disfavor with or sort of not really appreciate. They loathe deeply, richly, sustainingly." Patrice, that's a lot of load on women's backs. What do you think? Is this how we roll? Is this really how we roll?
I would like to think that women build a case rather than just loathe instantly. So I think the Time magazine piece was meant to be pretty humorous. There are some truths there, and I think that there are really, really strong, passionate feelings for and against Sarah Palin. And there are some serious reasons to, I think hate is a strong word, but for me, there's some serious reasons to dislike her that go with her policies.
Give me an example.
I mean, I think there are some people who have the perception that adding a woman to the GOP ticket made it the automatic correct choice for female voters, but the person at the top of the ticket, John McCain, voted against the Equal Pay Act, you know, and a lot of Sarah Palin's policies go directly against many of the most hard-fought achievements for women's rights, and as an animal lover, her policies really frighten me.
Now, Eric, when you think about the gender politics of this race, I mean, like the racial politics of this race, they've been so amazingly convoluted. So you have a woman who's the front runner for the Democrats, who's a former first lady, who then goes on to be criticized for everything from her stance on health care to her pantsuits, and who is believed to be loved by some women and hated by others. And then at the last minute, you get a Republican vice presidential nominee who is criticized for everything from her child rearing to the way that she winks during debates. What is going on here? And are women going to come out better in the end, women as leaders, going to come out better in the end after this election?
No, I think a lot of it has to do with who the women were. No one really knew Sarah Palin up until now. So now they are just now getting to know her. And what they don't like about her has nothing to do with her being a woman, per se. I think it has a lot more to do with her issues, her agenda, and her being contradictory to what John McCain is about. I mean, how can a woman go and say she's a part of that ticket when he is someone that does not even approve of equal pay? So she automatically becomes someone that feels the same way he does, and I think that's what it's more about. And as far as Hillary Clinton, I mean, she had this big group of women that was all about her. They didn't care about her policy. They were supporting her only because she was a woman. So I don't think it's as bad as with her or was with her as it is with Palin. I think Palin just like is for other reasons.
All right. I want to actually move on to something that happened on the campaign trail. Basically, Sarah Palin was out this weekend and she said, quote, "There's a place in hell reserved for women who don't support other women. Let's see how that comment is turned into whatever it's turned into in tomorrow's papers." And she was quoting Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. First of all, she got the quote slightly wrong. And then she got Madeleine Albright on her case. The former Secretary of State then released something saying, "Though I am flattered that Governor Palin has chosen to cite me as a source of wisdom, what I said had nothing to do with politics. This is yet another example of McCain and Palin distorting the truth, and all the more reason to remember that this campaign is not about gender." She goes on and then says she supports Obama, Biden. So, Sean, who won that round?
Well, I guess I give that round to Madeleine Albright. I mean, I think the challenge is you'll even hear conservative commentators like Sean Hannity now try to call Sarah Palin a feminist or a womanist. And when people really evaluate her stance and the views that she holds, that just doesn't really hold up. And so I think a lot of women are really angry that Sarah Palin is trying to come in as kind of a pseudo-feminist, but it doesn't really match up. And so when you really hold her record to that stance, it really frustrates women, including people like Madeleine Albright.
I mean, do you think that it's just simply one of these things where you know, politics is a rough and tumble sport, and Sarah Palin's just got to do what she's got to do, whether or not.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's gonna come at it, you know, strong and rough. And so I think the problem on some levels is there are so few women in politics at this level that Sarah Palin, even though I disagree with so many of her views, she is coming under some sexism and some scrutiny because she is dealing with things from her clothes and the winks and the way she sounds in a way that you just don't see even with Biden or Obama or McCain. And so she's going to have to be tough to even overcome some of those things.
But there's a reason she's coming under scrutiny. I mean, come on, she's on Katie Couric and Charles Gibson coming across as if she don't have a brain cell in her head. And then she goes before a national audience at a debate and she just talks about speaking points and not answering questions.
And she performs for the camera, the winking. It's just, it's
right, the winking, I mean, come on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about policy. Where do you think, because I want to transition us into the debate preview for tomorrow, but on policy, is there anything that you've learned over the past few days as there was the vice presidential debate that you felt that either Senator Biden or Governor Palin really made a point of clarifying for you? Because I think one of the things that happens is a lot of times we talk, and as we were just talking, about metapolitics, like how people portray themselves and all that. But on a level of policy, what was clarified for you or reiterated in a way that you felt this was a strong point, you know, over the course of the debates or around the debates? Patrice.
I mean, specifically in this last debate, I would say it wasn't really a game changer for me. I did not walk away from that debate feeling that I learned anything new about Sarah Palin's policies or where she really stood. I felt that she, you know, it was a performance for her base, and it didn't reach me as somebody who was, you know, on the other side of her beliefs.
But what about her or Senator Biden? I mean, even if it wasn't something new, what do you think that she was really emphasizing or he was really emphasizing? What do you think their main selling point was on a policy level?
I mean, I guess Biden, for me, I mean, I think a lot of what he had to say was about, I got a real sense of professionalism and experience from him and knowledge. And from her, I think she was kind of more trading on being folksy and personality. So, I mean, I really can't say there was any one policy point that she made that really, oh, that made me change my mind about what Sarah Palin had to say. It didn't work.
Sean or Eric, did either of you get a strong policy, a bit of knowledge or wisdom from the past couple days?
Sure, absolutely. I think particularly in the debate and even in these past few days, the differences between the Obama, Biden, and McCain, Palin perspective on Iraq and Afghanistan is very, very clear. I mean, I think Palin kind of made it clear that she is still kind of towing the McCain line of staying in Iraq, if not indefinitely, for a long time, and that pulling out is a defeat. She's against the timeline. Whereas Biden, even though he's had some votes to the contrary, made it clear that he was in full support of Obama's plan of putting in place a timeline for withdrawal, and I think that's a huge issue. And even though it's kind of taken a back seat with the economy of the way it's going right now and even today, I think that issue is something that some voters are going to go to the polls and vote based on their differences on that issue alone.
I want to go through each of you and ask the fabulous question. What would you ask if you were allowed to ask a question in tomorrow's town hall style debate? Because this is going to be moderated by NBC's Tom Brokaw. There's been a lot of attack ad, you know, politics between Senators Obama and McCain. So I'm going to start with you, Patrice. If you were there in the room tomorrow night, what would you ask?
I guess I'd probably want to ask John McCain. I know that he came out against using really negative smears in some of his, you know, in his campaign ads, and he said specifically that Reverend Wright was not going to be an issue that was on the table. However, Sarah Palin went to the New York Times, I think it was today or yesterday, and made statements about Reverend Wright. So does that not go directly against what he said his campaign was going to do? And by speaking out, is she representing his campaign, or does he have a problem with that?
All right. Well, Eric, what about you? What would you ask?
I would simply ask John McCain, do he know what the issues are? Because he seems to flip-flop on almost everything. He last week said he didn't think there was an economic issue facing this country. Then he went on to kind of change his stance as it relates to the war. So what is it about the issues that you feel are important to the American people?
Sean, what do you think?
Absolutely. Well, since we had two kind of questions posed to McCain, I think I would pose a question to Obama. And I would love to give him a chance, since it's already in the news and he only addressed it kind of slightly with Hillary in a Hillary Clinton debate. I would ask Obama to clarify his relationship with Bill Ayers and then give any perspective into any impact or influence that would have on him today. I think he could very easily put that to rest if he had an opportunity to address it. And I really could guess that that might be asked tomorrow.
Overall, do you think people are going to be looking more for style than substance? First of all, we're going to take a break in a second. But just quickly, Patrice, do you think people are looking for more style or substance in this upcoming debate?
I think this debate is going to be very special, and people are looking for a game changer. I personally hope to see less winking, and I think that style has worked in the past. So, I mean, I think the smart candidate would have a balance between style and substance, because I think that people do want to see a little bit of personality. They do want to see a little bit of a show and make these issues, like, come alive in that way, although he really needs to stick to what people, you know, the real issues of the campaign. It needs to be serious and not undercut by performing.
All right, guys. Well, hang on with us. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with more of the Bloggers Roundtable. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back with our Bloggers Roundtable with Eric Brown of the Detroit News, Patrice Yersic of AfroBella.com, and Sean King, who blogs at SeanInTheCity.com. So, guys, I'm going to have us jump right in with another topic that's related to politics. But, you know, viral video has been so important this time around. People are sending around comedy and people are sending around all sorts of crazy stuff, but there's a very serious video from the secretary treasurer of the AFL-CIO labor union, Richard Trumka. He's giving a very impassioned speech against racism and in support of Barack Obama. Let's take a listen.
We can't tap dance around the fact that there's a lot of folks out there just like that woman, and a lot of them are good union people. They just can't get past the idea that there's something wrong with voting for a black man. Well, those of us who know better can't afford to sit silently or look the other way while it's happening.
Sean, he went on. I've seen this full clip, and he goes on for several minutes and really takes people to task for not facing their own racism. Do you think, coming from a working-class white man in the labor movement, that this is really going to make a difference?
Absolutely. I think it has made a difference. And, you know, the funny thing is that speech was actually given several months ago, and it just picked up steam because when it really got covered, Gar Reynolds in his blog, Presentation Zen, covered it, and that really helped pick it up as well. When you see this speech, his passion and the response from 15,000 people that are there watching it, it had a real impact on those people. Those people then went to their cities, their states, their jobs, and I'm convinced that you couldn't have been there and heard that speech and not been moved. I saw people crying, people up on their feet, and it was almost an exclusively white crowd. And so I think when you hear that speech and see that the McCain campaign has moved out of Michigan, that Obama is tied up in places like Ohio and Virginia, you have to wonder, what impact did that speech and the organization of the Obama campaign to follow up on things like that, what impact has that had? And I think you would have to conclude it had a big impact.
Patrice, I had an interesting experience this weekend. First of all, everyone's in racial confession mode. Everybody feels, sometimes I'm like, that's a good thing. And sometimes I'm like, not so good. We're just basically, you know, and we've talked about this before on the show, sometimes people just come up to you and confess their racial issues. But I had one of those moments where I was in a cab and there was an Iranian immigrant cab driver. And he basically said, I didn't like Obama. And then I realized that I was really jealous of him. Why was his life so good and my life wasn't? And then once I realized that I was jealous of him and, you know, how could a black man go so far? And I was jealous based on that, I could let go of it. And now I can vote for him. I was like, Wow, that's a lot of information, Patrice. You know, first of all, have you ever been the participant in a racial confession? And secondly, what do you think of a statement like the one that that gentleman made to me?
That's an amazing statement. I mean, that's therapy time for him, and you're stuck in the back of his cab. I've had that before, and I think there are people who are looking to have conversations that we've been avoiding for years, and I think that this particular election cycle is bringing up feelings and thoughts that people have tried to bury and whitewash, and it's a remarkable time that we are living in right now. I really think so. And I just wanted to get back to the speech. I was absolutely blown away by that speech. It was so brave and so honest, and to see, you know, a white man of that age and of his, you know, working background say something that I know would resonate in the black community and has been felt in the black community for so long. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And I think, you know, maybe through speeches like that and through having conversations like what you had in the cab with this gentleman, you know, people are really starting to examine why they feel the way they feel about certain people and why they make the judgments that they make.
Let me make a quick point about the racial confessions, Farai, because I am just blown away by the fact that people constantly refer to him as a black man. Do we forget that one of his parents was white? And if he had more European features, how would this race be about? Would it have been over with after June 3rd? Because as long as we allow people to just constantly call him a black man, that gives people a chance and opportunity to display their racial prejudices.
But, isn't he, for all intents and purposes, processed as a black man in this political race?
Only because we have allowed that to take place. I mean, if he had more European features, what would we be saying about Barack Obama, or if his name was Richard Smith?
No, I mean, I think it's a question that comes up a lot. But do you think at this point in time, maybe I'm wrong, but Sean, do you think that there's any question, although that he has, he's definitely, it's not an either or, you can be black and biracial, but do you think that there's any question, Sean, that he's being processed in the public lens as a black man?
No, not at all. And in some ways, it's a self-designation that Barack Obama has made, and it's a designation that good or bad, most biracial people in this country classify themselves as one or the other. And generally, if you are black and white in this country for decades, for hundreds of years even, that means you're going to be processed and classified as an African-American. And so I think people, though, know that underneath the surface there is this story, and I think that plays in places like Colorado and New Mexico and California. People know that even though there's this kind of common designation of Barack Obama as a black man, that there's more to him than meets the eye.
All right. Well, there's a lot more to talk about, but no more time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That was Sean King, who blogs at seaninthecity.com. He joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Patrice Yersik, who blogs at afrobella.com. She joined us from WLRN in Miami. And Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News. He joined us from WEMU in Detroit. How do you spell relief? How about $700 billion? On Friday, the federal government promised to target $700 billion, once again with a B, to help the economy. That didn't help stock markets, though, here or around the world. Joining me to break down the latest in economics is Keith Reed. He's a business reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Farai. How you doing?
I'm doing great, but not so much the stock market. It fell below 10,000, the Dow Jones, lowest it's been in about 4 years. Yet you've got this $700 billion bill signed into law by the president. Why, after this much touted, much debated bill actually made it through the system, is the stock market still going crazy?
Because it takes some time for $700 billion to work its way through the system. And one of the things you have to understand is that there was never a consensus, at least among experts in the financial world and economists, about whether or not the $700 billion was going to either A, provide an immediate turnaround, or whether it was going to be the long-term fix that we needed. It's going to take at least several months, maybe 3 to 6 months, to figure out whether or not this is going to have a long-term impact. In the interim, getting it passed passed. The first question that Wall Street has was, is it going to get passed? And so last week you saw the huge drop in a loss of more than $1 trillion in wealth in the stock market on a single day because people worried whether or not it was about whether or not it was going to get passed. Now it's been passed and the worry is, well, is it enough? And we just don't know yet whether or not it's enough.
When you think about what enough is, I mean, how do you even measure what enough is? Well, I guess part of it is that you measure the stock market. But what are the other indicators that say this is working?
Well, I mean, you have to look at all the classic, financial indicators that are out there. You have to look at jobs and what's going on with jobs. Well, we lost 159,000 new jobs last month. Unemployment is the highest that it's been in several years, and so jobs is a big indicator. You also have to look at the availability of credit. Credit is still so tight today. You have to remember that underlying all of this is the quote unquote credit crunch, the phenomenon by which banks cannot borrow from each other, therefore they can't lend either to the government or to consumers. Well, what happened today? The Federal Reserve Bank actually went, the nation's central bank said that it's going to increase by $300 billion, the amount that it lends overnight to banks when they come in and they need an emergency loan to try to bring some more liquidity to the system and get banks lending again. So the job picture doesn't look any better. The credit picture doesn't look any better. And so whether or not the economy ultimately whether or not the $700 billion bailout for Wall Street will make things look better again remains to be seen, at least for the next several months.
I want to reserve the right to go back to talking about world stock markets. But since you mentioned jobs, we have to go there. Like you said, 159,000 jobs. Zoop. That is tremendous. You know, jobs vanishing faster than they have in 5 years. And yet, on the other hand, the House passed a bill that could extend unemployment benefits. It still has to go to the Senate. So on the one hand, let's start by breaking down what's going on with the job situation. What are we really seeing here?
In short, a hell of a lot of jobs are being lost. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. There's no analysis that needs to be done. There just are a lot of people who are losing jobs, and those jobs are not being created in anywhere near the numbers that they're being lost. 760,000 jobs have disappeared this year alone. That brings the nation's overall unemployment rate up to 6.1%. If you're African American, actually, the rate is 11.4% at this point. So, of course, the old adage about the economy having a flu and the economy having a cold and black folk catching the flu remains true here, and that was predicted earlier this year. Those jobs are just disappearing very, they're disappearing very, very quickly. What the government did is sort of an indicator that they don't believe that the jobs are going to come back anytime soon. And that also, goes back to whether or not the credit markets and the equity markets believe that this is going to be over anytime soon and businesses begin expanding again. There is really very little confidence, very little certainty in any of the major sectors of the economy right now that this is going to change. And so the government responded and said, listen, we need to do something to help people who may be out of work for an extended amount of time.
One of our other contributors, Dr. Julianne Malvo of Bennett College, has made the point that something like extending unemployment benefits is a really direct way to reach people who have been working and who do need help. And yet, I just see dollar signs rolling before my eyes. And in fact, there was a story on television about the debt clock, America's debt clock, that the numbers kept rolling up. And now they may be out of space, literally, that we may have to flip over another digit so that, this kind of performance art / informational object may cease to be current because we have just run up so much debt. Is this a good use of money? Relative, and what I mean by this is unemployment benefits. Are they a good value for American taxpayers?
They may be in the short term. One of the things you have to remember is that in the calculation of the unemployment figures, you do lose some people. I mean, some people simply get wiped off the rolls if you have been out of work for X number of months and you stop looking for a job. You get taken out of the unemployment figures. Some economists do believe that the unemployment figures almost always skew low because you have this disaffected worker who gets taken off because he stopped looking for a job. He hasn't been able to find one. To the extent that it does bring some relief to people who absolutely need the money, who aren't going to be able to pay their bills. I mean, at the end of the day, the taxpayer does end up footing, you know, would you rather give the guy directly, give somebody who's out of work directly the ability to be able to pay his bills, keep his lights on, or do you want it to come on the back end when you're giving him energy assistance if he goes to apply for food stamps, if he goes to down to the welfare office or what have you? You know, it's sort of your choice, but the money's going to come out anyway. To your point about the debt clock, I was kind of turning this over in my head a little bit earlier. And when you think about the amount of money that we're pouring into bailouts of any different sort, it is really staggering. I mean, this whole thing with the Federal Reserve and the move that they made this morning of adding another 300 or of increasing their lending capability by $300 billion to banks, in addition to $700 billion that the Treasury Department is going to preside over, in addition to $25 billion for the auto industry, in addition to whatever may be coming. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it all smacks of robbing Peter to pay Paul at some point. Someone is ultimately going to have to pay for this, and it probably won't be in my lifetime. It may not be in my children's lifetime. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of debt that's being there's a big bill that's being passed along from person to person to person with this financial crisis.
Speaking of bucks and bills, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger sent a distress signal to D.C. on Friday. He said the state might need an emergency loan of $7 billion to maintain day-to-day operations. It is pretty remarkable that the eighth largest economy in the world, which is effectively what California would be if broken out from, you know, the national statistics, would be in this position. What does that say about how states are faring?
What it says is that states are in the same position that a lot of companies are in. I mean, if you really at the heart of this crisis, and I can't stress this enough, the heart of this is the fact that our economy is simply tied to people, companies, government entities borrowing. Period. Point blank. We've reached the point where borrowing literally fuels the economy. It's not production. It's even not so much consumerism, unless the consumerism is financed with debt. Most companies pay their, or many companies, if not most, pay their employees, pay their bills on a month-to-month basis while they wait for their receipts to come in. They pay those bills by borrowing. So they tap into a credit facility. They go to a bank and say, hey, listen, this is my payroll. I've got receipts coming in. I can pay you back. Give me the money to pay all my employees. Many states are simply in the same place. When you hear about a state selling or a city selling a bond, what that bond is essentially debt, so that it can bring in the money that it needs short term to pay for police, firefighters, teachers, etc. California came to the government last week and said, listen, you know, we need $7 billion. And I know you're giving $700 billion to Wall Street, but we need $7 billion because we can't pay the teachers. And some people think that, you know, what Schwarzenegger was doing was putting a little bit of pressure on Congress to get a deal done. But at the end of the day, it's a reality that states do need to borrow money. And with the credit markets seized up the way they are, mm-hmm. not even the state of California can borrow what it needs to pay the bills that it has to pay.
Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and blogs for BET's finance page at $1 out of 15 cents. He joined us from member station WVXU in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Even some hip-hop fans won't play the music for their kids. Especially if you're listening to the radio, you don't know what kind of language or lyrics you're going to get. But poet Nikki Giovanni thinks hip-hop is critical for children. She's put together poetry and hip-hop that's suitable for young ears. It's called Hip-Hop Speaks to Children, a celebration of poetry with a beat. Our own Tony Cox got a chance to sit down and speak with Nikki Giovanni about putting a spin on children's lit.
Allow me to introduce myself. They call me the showstopper, the dime dropper, the spin move to the left, reverse jam popper.
This is a multimedia book. And so we have the poems and we have illustrations, which are fantastic. We have a CD, and then we have, I think, 34 tracks on that CD. So we wanted to bring a whole package so that you know, an eight-year-old can sit and watch and listen to it. But more, because I'm a parent, my son is old now, but I wanted a book that if my kid was younger, I could look at it with him and learn something and recognize what's good and what's maybe not so good, what I would let him listen to and what I would prefer that he didn't.
I wasn't sure what to expect, and then when I opened it and read it and listened to it, it's wonderful. How'd you come up with this idea?
Hip-hop is a legitimate artistic form. And it just appeared to me that there was a hole in the market someplace. And it seemed to me that parents wanted to say to themselves, you know, should I let my children listen to this music? Well, this is wonderful music, and you can't let some of the other ends of hip-hop determine, you know, how we look at it. So I wanted to put a book together that I thought gave us some historical foundation, taking it back to its origins and bringing it up to essentially Tony the Future.
One of the things that was really interesting about it, even for me as a person who sometimes cannot figure out what is being said in hip-hop, the lyrics in here make it really clear. And you have so many different people. I see Kanye West, A Tribe Called Quest. You have Queen Latifah. You got the old Sugar Hill Gang. How did you decide who to put in here and who not to? Because it's such an eclectic mix.
Well, there was no way to get everybody. But we actually wanted to start with the origin of the vernacular. But hip-hop, being a vernacular, goes back to opera. So we went back to the square, and we tried to deal with the origins coming out of the square, which is just going to lead us into a flow. So then we come to, of course, the sermon, God's trombones. We come to the creation. And we have Val Gray Ward, you know, preaching that. Then we come to, of course, Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And we have Oni Lasana is going to rap We Wear the Mask, which is just a mind blower. She just does a great, great job with that. We're going to have Du Bois. So we're beginning to move it on up. We're going to have Langston Hughes. You know, they're stair steps. And so we just continue to bring it out. Now, when we get to the modern world, I always knew, of course, there would be Tupac, or I always knew that there would be Eleanor Greenfield, or, of course, you had to have Harlan Hopscotch. You know, how could you not have Maya? But when we get beyond, for me, beyond Tupac is about the limits. And so I had a really good crew, to use the hip-hop term. I had a really good crew to help me weed out some things because we wanted to cast as wide a net as possible.
You know, one of the examples that you have in here that is not associated with hip-hop of the modern era, but it certainly is hip-hop from an earlier generation, is the song, the collaboration between Bobby Timmons and Oscar Brown Jr., That Dare. And you talk about why you included that in here. Talk about that one a little bit.
Well, of course, first of all, Oscar was so important. You know, if this book had been aimed a little higher, a little older, I don't mean higher, but a little older, we would have included Bid 'Em In. Bid 'Em In, Bid 'Em In, Bid 'Em In. You know, Oscar, it was the master of the oral tradition. And of course, everybody loves That Dare because that's what fathers and sons do. Hey, Daddy, what That Dare? And I've always loved the Bobby Timmons song. So there was no way that we were going to go without Oscar. The question was which one?
Hey, Daddy, what That Dare? And why that under there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, hey, look it over there.
Now, you also have a song in here. It's called, a poem called From Ladies First by Queen Latifah. And a number of these, we should tell people that the artists themselves actually read their poetry or they perform the lyrics. And in this case, Queen Latifah does this particular song. What was it about this song that made this? Is it right to call it a song or right to call it a poetry?
It's a song. I mean, this is their music. But, of course, you know, Queen Latifah is a great girl. And, I mean, if I had a daughter or niece, you know, I'd certainly wanted to be Queen Latifah. But Queen Latifah broke into rap, you have to recall, at the point that it was at a time that it was really very male-oriented. And that's one reason that it was almost no doubt which one we wanted to use from her. That's going to be Ladies First.
You said that the ladies couldn't make it. You must be blind. If you don't believe what here, listen to this rhyme. Ladies First, there's no time to rehearse. I'm divine and my mind expands throughout the universe.
You call it the hip-hop speaks to children, but you also have blues in here. There's one long track blues by Sterling Brown, which is performed by Josephine Cameron, and it's it has a very nice sound to it, and it's interesting to be included in something that's titled hip hop.
Well, what would we do without the blues?
You
know,
true.
It's the same thing that we have the creation by James Weldon Johnson, which is a sermon. What would we do without the holiness cadence? Without bringing the way that the African Americans during slavery conveyed information, you have a people who were subject to an enforced illiteracy.
Have you done anything else like this?
No, I haven't. But the older you get, the more you realize that, and I'm just an old school teacher in my heart, or actually an old storyteller, and you think people don't really know the stories. They don't know where it comes from. People are busy. And so if I can find a way to make a book that is going to appeal to kids to want to read it, then they'll ask questions about it.
Let me ask a big favor of you, Nikki Giovanni. Would you share with us just a little of the reading of Ego Tripping? I'm looking at the words of it now. I don't know if you have it in front of you.
What
if you've
page
committed
are you? I was going to say, what page
it's
are you
on? It's on page 42.
Okay, thank you. I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle. So swift, you can't catch me.
That was poet Nikki Giovanni speaking to Tony Cox in our NPR West studios. Giovanni's new book is called Hip Hop Speaks to Children. Mississippi rap artist David Banner creates music that plays well on the charts and in the clubs. He's also testified on Capitol Hill in defense of hip-hop. He came by NPR West to talk politics and give us the latest on his new album, The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Thank you guys for having me.
Okay, first we have to talk about the first thing that you did when you came in. You gave me a hug, which I loved. But the second thing is you went in search of chamomile tea.
Right.
Do your fans think of you as a chamomile tea kind of guy?
I think my fans don't know what the hell to think of me no more. it's been a blessing and it's been a problem. All my career, I've been trying to, you know, really figure out who David Banner is going to be, because Lavelle Crump happens to be such a complex person. And for those who don't know who Lavelle Crump is, that's my real name. In order to be successful, it seems, in especially the market now with, you know, everything going to hell, you know, from the banks to the record companies, you know, you in order to really, I tell people all the time, you know, you can be the most spiritual, you can be the most political rapper, but if don't nobody hear you or nobody buying your records or you're not getting played on the radio, doesn't matter.
So does that affect how you make your music? Do you think then, well, I have to change who I am in order to be David Banner as opposed to Lavelle Crump? And David Banner, of course, being already this archetype of a shadow side of a superhero, the name that you took on. Mm. Does that mean that you are forced to play a role?
You know, with me being from Mississippi, you know, and not being from New York or L.A., it was so very hard for me to put together a team. You know, you have people that you trust, but maybe people who don't have the power to push, you know, past some of those boundaries. And then with us already being Southerners on top of that and having to fight against that, on top of that, during the time I came out, Southern music wasn't as popular. You had exceptions to the rules. But then also with me being a very opinionated, tall, strong, dark-skinned black man, you know, regardless of what people may think, you know, was also, you know, something that I've always had to battle with on top of, you know, doing the type of music that I do. Then those people who are my fans who also know that I do stand for something, then I also have to battle with the fact of them asking me, well, why do you make the type of music that you make on the other side?
We want to play a little bit of that music that you do.
Well, I hope you. I wonder what you're gonna pick.
Well, we won't leave you in suspense. First track on this album, So Long, has a political bent to it.
Three sixes, no sevens. This is Bushonomics. George is our modern day Ronald Reagan. I pray to God in the midst of pagans. I'm just saying, when do we stop playing? When do we stop pimping and start spraying? 50 shots for every cop that pops Sean Bell, his body land. But they are quick because they know that our generation won't do sh-
You know, you hit, first came to my attention around Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And in this song, you say, our generation won't do bleep. Do you believe that, really? That our generation is politically useless? Or?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm going to be honest all the time. Sometimes you have to say things that will put a fire under people. You know, I have total confidence in our generation. I have total confidence in our ability to move, shake, and do things. But I think, you know, with the internet, with sometimes, you know, with what the enemy does, and from a spiritual and from a physical perspective, they either give you no information, the wrong information, or too much information. Right now we have too much information, and then I think once kids are able to disseminate the truth, and I think it's coming into fruition with what's happening with the banks and what's happening with our financial situation.
Do you think hip-hop is a force for political good, political enlightenment, social good, ethical good? What do you believe?
People always put it on rap, you know, rap isn't saying nothing, but, you know, what are public schools really teaching our children? Are public schools giving our kids just enough to, you know, succeed every day, or are they giving them enough information to compete globally? It's a global society now. You're not competing against the guy that's sitting next to you. It's a global society. So, you know, it was funny when they were talking about bailing out Wall Street. Well, bail out the educational system. You know, in not just in the black community, but especially in the black community, you know, in the same breath. You know, what happened to teaching kids how to play instruments? What about, you know, passing on that manhood, that name, that sense of pride, that sense of family? My passion comes because of something that has happened. But nobody ever talks about what happened before. Nobody ever talks about that history and all that stuff that made me upset. Why I have Mississippi tattooed on my back? It's for a reason, not a season.
Why do you have Mississippi tattooed on your back?
I carry some responsibility on my back. No matter how many movies I do, no matter how much money I get, when I take off my shirt, I will always be reminded of what I'm supposed to be doing. Whether I do it or not, it's something that I will have to pay for, that I will have to stand or fall for.
It sounds like you're pretty hard on yourself.
Who knows? But if not, you know, if not who? Because if I'm light on myself, then am I going to do the things that I'm supposed to do? You know, because everybody's light and they're partying and they're having fun, but folks are messed up.
Let's listen to a little bit of one of...
And we can lighten up if you want to.
No, we will.
Cutting is a habit. Put it in the air. Hey, I'm seeing Sharon Wood. Come on.
Look, let's play some of your music. I Get By.
South to the day that the Lord comes to get me. This is how it was growing up in Mississippi. When I ran around the hood in BKs and troops. When the Queen Boys were just a young dance group in Westwick. I remember, man, when Chucky got shot. Lionel Bleed, man, and Jackson Mall parking lot.
Now that is one of this intersection of hip-hop, mm-hmm. that, you know, other artists have had, which is that you can have some really serious lyrics, and then you have a beat behind them where you're like, I want to be on the dance floor. Then you realize you're dancing to a song about people getting killed and people struggling. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you to put those things together?
People are dying. And when Vietnam was happening, you felt that. We're in a recession. We're feeling that because of gas prices. But, you know, people were more vocal. And it is more powerful to give people a facade that they're free than to have shackles on them, because the shackles will always be a constant reminder that you need to get free.
David Banner.
Yeah.
Not a man with a lot of opinions.
Ha! Stanton is a hat. Matter of fact, brand new album in stores, greatest story ever told. Go buy 4 or 5 copies. See, I done learned my lesson.
Oh, on that note, David Banner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was hip-hop recording artist David Banner with a lot of exposition on some very deep topics who do not take him lightly. His new album is called The Greatest Story Ever Told. He joined us in our studios in Culver City, California. You can watch this interview online. Just go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.